The following audio is brought to you by Summerside Community Church in London, Ontario. For more information on Summerside, visit us online at www.summersidechurch.ca.
There are sentences you never forget. A doctor sits down and says, "It's cancer." A relationship ends with, "I can't do this anymore, it's done." A phone call starts with, "There's been an accident." And sometimes you hear the opposite. That kind of suddenly takes all the weight off your chest and changes your season, like a snap. It's benign. We're expecting. You're approved. I'm telling you, one sentence can change the emotional temperature of an entire season of your life. You know this is true. Advent is full of those types of sentences. We've been hearing them week after week. It's not sentimental or seasonal fluff when you hear it from the scripture. Like, "I hope my December is better than my November was." No. We're talking about a kind of joy that's, and a kind of sentence that's deep and profound and life-changing. And I want to give you a big one right now. In fact, you just heard it. But it's written by the Apostle John, and this is something I want you to let settle in today. John 1, verse 14. Listen to it again. "The Word became flesh and made His dwelling among us. We have seen His glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth." Now, this Advent week, traditionally, that candle and this theme is traditionally about joy. And you're thinking, "I didn't see the word joy at all in that verse, Leo." True. But what did you think carols like "Joy to the World" really are about? Crazy sweaters and eggnog? I mean, actually, later in this very same gospel, we'll hear Jesus unpack it better for us. He says, "I have told you these things so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete." That is far deeper than holiday cheer. We're talking complete joy, not fragile joy, not joy that cracks when real life shows up at tax time. So where does that joy come from? Now, to answer the question, we're, as we've been doing, not focused on the manger scenes yet. The ones that you see so well and so wonderfully described in Matthew and Luke. John takes a different angle. He decides he wants to go way back. He wants to go back before Bethlehem. He wants to go back before creation. He actually goes back before there was such a thing as time. And he hands us the first 18 verses of this great gospel, often called the prologue. It holds the entire meaning of Christmas. Now, I'm going to do something different today. I haven't done this before here with you. I'm actually going to take one verse, and I'm going to make that verse our anchor for all that we're going to do. I'm just going to be drawing, as I go through the verse, phrase by phrase, from the surrounding verses. But one thing I can guarantee you is by the time you walk out today, you're going to know verse 14. I think we can all do one verse. You with me? So, one sentence can change everything. And this is it in verse 14. Four phrases in there, four things to get dug down deep. And my aim here is not just that you understand it. My aim is that you receive it. Because this isn't just truth. This is joy offered. It's Christmas explained. This is it. This is the sentence that changes everything. So let's get into it. And get situated with this first idea. Let's start with who Jesus really is. So we'll take the first four words of verse 14. It goes like this. The Word became flesh. Now, slow that down a bit. Don't let any familiarity with that numb you to it. John is making a massive claim here that no religion has ever dared to make. That God didn't just speak or have a prophet write something. God became human and lived amongst us in history, not in myth or in a fable or an allegory. No, we're talking flesh, bones, skin, heartbeat. He's called the Word. Now look at verse 1 with me. If you want to follow along in your Bibles, it says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Now, I will tell you straight up, you could spend 10 lifetimes unpacking all of the first 18 verses of John. It's that amazing and that profound. We're not doing that today. But read it again. In the beginning, so notice right away, it's not once upon a time was the Word. Not began the Word. Not he, the Word started. He already existed, John's saying. And the Word was with God. That's face-to-face relationship with the Father. And the Word was God. Not like God, not a small g God, not divine-ish God. And John, when he talks here, he's not saying Jesus kind of showed up sort of a little bit late to the party, saying, so, you know, catch me up. What did I miss? No, he's the reason there's a story to talk about at all. You're still thinking, yeah, but why is he called the Word? Admittedly, kind of heady. I get it. I could go in two directions. I'd give you a one-hour lecture on it, or I'm just going to simplify it to this sentence to help you move it along. Jesus is called the Word here because when God decided he wanted to explain himself to people, to humanity, he didn't give a lecture. He gave a person who is the explanation. John keeps going in verse 2. It says, he was with God in the beginning. So he's distinct from the Father, yet fully divine. Verse 3, through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. Meaning, everything you know, everything sits under his authority. Mountains, oceans, lungs, galaxies, gravity, you name it, it's there. Even the morning sun that annoyingly hits you when you're driving east on the 401. I mean, it all begins with him. So if you've ever questioned your worth, know this. If you're sitting here today breathing, you're borrowing breath that he imagined. If your heart is beating today, he's the reason it knows how. You exist, loved ones, because he said so. There is nothing casual about your existence. Nothing. And then John shifts from creation and purpose now to verse 4. We've been singing about it. In him was life, and that life was the light of all mankind. I love the combination there, L squared, life and light. The kind that reveals truth and exposes lies at the same time. Now, I don't know about you, but you know when you go through seasons where life kind of feels like everything's just a bit of a fog? Just a fog, you know, you just, where am I? What's going on? What's happening? I can't quite see everything. You're functioning, but you can't quite get it. You're busy, but especially emotionally, you're not alive. You feel that way. And John says that the life and light that Jesus brings, it clarifies. It awakens people. Sometimes it does all of these things at once, clarifying, awakening, confronting, comforting. And then he adds a line that maybe it actually may describe your year here. Verse 5. The light shines in what? The darkness. And the darkness has not overcome it. Darkness is real. I don't have to tell you that. That's not profound. We don't pretend it isn't as Christians. I mean, you just have to spend 5 minutes looking at your news feed or sit with your own thoughts for a week. You don't have to be a theologian to know when darkness is in the room. But John says darkness doesn't get the final vote. It may push, but it doesn't conquer. It'll whisper, but it doesn't define. I was reading an article in Forbes magazine that was released a piece last year, and it noted something that I've observed for years, but it was neat to see it done by secular clinicians, I guess. And this was their finding, that the rates of anxiety and burnout continue to increase strongly, even in seasons of people's lives when everything is going well or improving. And the researchers that did this study called this the rising ambient darkness. Ambient kind of meaning that background noise of life, the background noise, that the hum, that is something I know that many of you feel every single day. There's just this noise cloud sitting over everything going on in your life. That's rising ambient darkness. I read that and I was thinking to myself, John saw that 2,000 years ago. I want to tell you, ambient darkness isn't sovereign. Don't let it be in your minds. Only Jesus is. So back to our anchor verse, verse 14, when it says, the Word became flesh. Understand this. The one who designed the human body took on a human body. The one who created nerve endings accepted the possibility of pain. The one who is self-sufficient put himself in a place where he could be hungry and tired and slandered and ignored and misunderstood. Why? Because love doesn't stay remote, is why. It doesn't send a memo. It comes close. Christmas is God refusing to love you from a distance. Can I ask you this question? Have you let the size of Jesus Christ get small in your minds? Have you shrunk him to fit either your desires or your pessimism? Because John will not let us start off his story or his gospel of Jesus with a small Jesus. Why? Because small Jesus can't save anyone. Small Jesus can't carry your guilt and sin. He can't carry your fears. Small Jesus can't deal with darkness. So before Advent tells us anything else, it says you don't worship a distant deity. You worship a God who moved close. So I needed to get that start with who Jesus really is, because we have to move through a portion here which is tragic in the story, but it'll help us as we move to the end. Here's the second thing today. Recognize how easily we miss him. Notice the next phrase in verse 14. And made his dwelling among us. So if the first phrase answers, who is he? This is answering, how close did he come? Answer, all the way. We got that. The phrase, made his dwelling among us, is interesting. It literally means, from the Hebrew, he pitched his tent with us. I like that because I love camping. For the entirety of my marriage, Kim and I have just been camping at provincial parks all over Ontario. By the way, today is our 34th wedding anniversary. So for 34 years, we've been doing this kind of camping. And so the picture, and if you love camping like I do, you know there's nothing better than a bunch of tents in a circle and the community there and the campfires and all that goes with that. And there's that sense here that he pitched his tent with us when he came. I love it. I'm trying to tell you, God didn't commute to earth. He moved in. Now, some of you hear that and think to yourself, yeah, but, you know, for me, Leo, God always feels distant. Just sort of an idea sometimes. I get that. But that's a feeling. And that feeling, while it may be real to you on a fact base, on a truth base, let me tell you, it's never distant on his side of the equation. He has not abandoned you. He is not pulling back on you. He didn't check out. And then John's going to help us feel the moment here by introducing a witness. Verse 6, he says, there was a man sent from God whose name was John. Now, we should probably get our Johns clear. The guy writing is the Apostle John. The witness he's talking about is John the who? The Baptist, okay? John the Baptist, he's describing him. Before Jesus preached or healed or called his disciples, God was preparing the soil. So he sends John the Baptist ahead to make sure no one missed what was about to happen. God doesn't just surprise us. He signals his mercy and grace before he even displays it. That's now in verse 7. He came as a witness to testify concerning that light, so that through him all might believe. That's pretty straight up. Notice he doesn't say so that all might behave. He doesn't say so that all might feel a spiritual tingling. No, so that all might believe. Boy, what a witness John was. I'm going to actually pull a verse out of sequence here on purpose because it'll help. Verse 15 of the first chapter of John, it says this. John testified concerning him. He cried out saying, This is the one I spoke about when I said, he who comes after me has surpassed me because he was before me. Don't miss those two words, cried out. That is urgency and warning. That is announcement energy. That's a herald. Like a herald comes before the king. Hear ye, hear ye. Because John wasn't doing sort of a, hey everyone, maybe you should give this guy a little look-see. No, that's not John the Baptist. No, he's shouting, pay attention. Someone is here who didn't start here. I may have arrived in Israel first, but he was first. And that tells you something about the incarnation, which if you weren't here last week, we went into a lot of detail on. I'm not going to go over that again, but I will tell you this. Jesus didn't come to impress you. He came to draw you to him. And then John clarifies something a lot of us really need to remember. Verse 8, he himself was not the light. That's John the Apostle talking about John the Baptist. He, John, was not the light. He came only as a witness to the light. Translation, there's only one Savior, and you're not it. In other words, John the Baptist knew his role. He wasn't the hero of this story. Never claimed to be. Now listen, if John the Baptist wasn't the hero of his own ministry, why would any of us try to be the hero of ours? Some of us here today are exhausted. Not just because of the December crazy we're all going through right now, but we're exhausted on a deeper level because we are trying to carry roles we were never meant, never designed, never created to carry. Fixer, redeemer, rescuer, self-saver. No wonder joy feels out of reach. You can't save yourself or try to save yourself and enjoy grace at the same time. It is impossible. And then John captures the tragedy of the human heart. Look at verse 9. The true light that gives light to everyone was coming to the into the world. Not a light. Not one of several good lighting options. No, the true light. And then verse 10, he was in the world, and though the world was made through him, this part always gets me, the world did not recognize him. Do you see how tragic that is? He steps into his own creation, and people shrug. They look at him like he's another face in the crowd. Kind of easy, though, for us to judge him, isn't it? As we sit here and look back at, I wouldn't have done that. You sure? We do the same thing in a different way. Jesus moves toward us, and we're too distracted to notice, or we're too proud. Or we're too convinced that we've already figured everything there is to know about him. But the wound gets even deeper. According to John, verse 11, he came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. You know, it's one thing when strangers don't bring you into their circle, but it is another when your own people won't. That is painful. That is tragic. Can you even imagine that? Just think about this creator, this incredible, I don't have words for Jesus right now. I need an angel's tongue. He comes into his own. If you read the Gospels, how was he treated? How was he received? The tragedy of that. And here's where this gets uncomfortably human for us. Sometimes when Jesus comes close, he comes in a way that we didn't want. He confronts a sin we've been protecting. He exposes a fear that we've been hiding and don't take to him. He calls us to obedience that we've been avoiding. And instead of receiving him, we resist him. I saw a recent survey online when I was flipping through trying to get to NHL.com, and I clicked on something else and I ended up on Psychology Today. But it got me because it had a little piece there about human beings that I found to be true in my observation. It's this. It described how people, when confronted with an uncomfortable truth about themselves, their first instinct, remember, this is secular psychologists doing a research paper. And this is their finding, that when they're confronted with an uncomfortable truth about themselves, the first instinct people have isn't to think about it and change, but to avoid it. We change the subject. We get busy. We distract ourselves. We go on offense. That's the human heart on autopilot. Jesus moves towards us and we dodge him without even realizing it. But the incarnation of Jesus will not let us dodge. He made his dwelling among us. Verse 14 says, he came all the way down. He stepped into our world with, and get this, with full awareness of what he was walking into. That alone deserves worship today. Look, God is not waiting for you to climb up spiritually to a level of approval, like you're playing some video game and just leveling up. He already came down to you. And if he was willing to move towards you, the painful question gets simple real fast. Will you resist him or welcome him? You're like, well, that's all fine and good, Leo, but what am I supposed to do with it? Well, that's where this next idea is so awesome. Look at this third thing today. Stand in awe of his glory. Back to our anchor verse. We have seen his glory, John says. The glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father. John isn't doing, I'm telling you, he's not doing a slick Christmas TED talk when he's talking here. He is making a claim no one thought was even possible, because all Jews who knew of the God of the Bible knew one thing very clear, crystal clear, and it's this. No one sees God's glory and lives. Holiness, the holiness of God was lethal to sinful humanity. So glory was veiled and distance was protection. So when John says we have seen his glory, he's not saying we had a touching spiritual moment. He's saying we saw what wasn't supposed to be survivable. You ask, where did he see this glory? Now, he could point to water turning to wine, storms obeying his voice, demons running terrified, bread multiplying, a girl raised from the dead. That's not what he's talking about. Those were all windows into glory. But if we were really to press him and say, no, John, You just made a big claim there. When did you see his glory? And John would tell you about the day that Jesus took Peter, James, and John up a mountain. We're just saying, go tell it on the mountain. Well, I'm talking about a mountain right now. The Mount of Transfiguration. Maybe you've read the story. I'll kind of summarize it for you. Jesus takes them up there, the inner circle of three. It's one of my favorite parts of the Gospels. And while they're up there, boom, Moses and Elijah appear. They're having their own little convo with Jesus. And Peter, James, and John are kind of like, they don't know what to make of this. Everyone, all three of them are kind of like a little bit off kilter. It would seem that John and James were a little bit more self-contained about it. Peter, as we would expect, he had to do something, and he was all over the map. A little bit, to me, honestly, when I read Peter's behavior on the Mount of Transfiguration, you can go read it for yourself. It's kind of funny, but he kind of behaves like a guy on his fifth pint of a Guinness. Okay, he's just saying things that don't make sense. He's overwhelmed, and to the point that after all of that, Elijah, Moses, Jesus, the three of them, Peter being Peter, God speaks, says, "This is my son. Listen to him." And in that moment, on the Mount of Transfiguration, Jesus reveals his glory to the three. It's like he unzipped the human part of him, and the glory of God appeared. And Peter, James, and John were not wiped out. This wasn't sort of a glimmer or a sparkle. It wasn't borrowed brightness like Moses got. No, for a moment, the humanity was concealed and peeled back, and that glory that always belonged to him broke through. John would never get over it. That moment was seared into John. And you can feel it when you read the Gospel of John. So he doubles down on it in verse 18. Later on, he just says, "No one has ever seen God, but the one and only Son, who is himself God and is in closest relationship with the Father. He has made him known." So he's saying, there was a time when seeing God meant death. That's what he's saying. But now seeing God means life. John wants you to know that. Jesus isn't just a messenger. He's the message, man. He's not just bringing you revelation. He is the revelation. Have you ever moved beyond information about Jesus to astonishment before him? Has that ever happened? Because there is a big difference between knowing facts about him and seeing his glory. Yeah, you can recite verses. Sure, you know a lot of Christian doctrine, but have you ever been stopped in your tracks by the reality of who it is we're actually talking about? Down in your soul, that this very Jesus who walked dusty roads is the eternal Son of God, who stepped out of God, the Father's presence, into flesh, lived amongst us, for you. Maybe you actually in this moment feel that. There's a sense of restlessness, a weight, a sense that maybe this isn't just a nice seasonal message to nod at and move on. If you're sensing that, that's God. And that's God saying, listen now. Because if Jesus is who God says he is, then he is not optional, he is not customizable to your preferences, and he is not comfortable. He's not a safe manger baby or a gentle storyteller that you manage. No, Jesus Christ is a lion. Do you remember C.S. Lewis's wonderful book, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? That wonderful scene. I mean, actually, can we just, by show of hands, has anyone read the book or seen a movie? Okay, good. So we sort of know this. Well, there's that incredible scene where the girls, Susan and Lucy, ask Mr. Beaver about Aslan, the lion. And we know that C.S. Lewis wrote Aslan as a pure allegory of Jesus Christ. But they're talking and they're nervous because they realize they're about to meet someone that they don't know how they're going to react to. I'm going to just quote a little bit from the book because it's moving to hear the dialogue. "Is he a man?" asked Lucy. "Aslan a man?" said Mr. Beaver sternly. "Certainly not. I tell you, he is the king of the wood and the son of the great emperor beyond the sea. Aslan a lion? He's the lion. He's the great lion." "Oh," said Susan, "I thought he would be a man. Is he safe? I should feel rather nervous about meeting a lion." "That you will, dearie, and no mistake," said Mrs. Beaver. "If there's anyone who can appear before Aslan without their knees knocking, they're either braver than most or just plain silly." I think if we wrote it today, we would use stronger words, but this is a long time ago. "Then he isn't safe?" said Lucy. "Safe," said Mr. Beaver. "Don't you hear what Mrs. Beaver tells you? Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe. But he's good. He's the king. I tell you, he's the king." What's that all about? What's going on there? C.S. Lewis is saying that although Aslan isn't tame or safe in the sense that they're worrying about, he is absolutely good. And that goodness is why they don't need to be afraid. And it ends with the girls feeling both a combination of fear and comfort and reverence and trust. I want to be clear with you. Jesus is not safe. If by safe you mean manageable, tame, or on your terms. But if you belong to him, you are safer than you could ever possibly be. You are safe in a deeper way. His glory no longer means judgment at all for you, because he bore that judgment already in your place. His presence no longer means distance because he closed it. The lion is good, and goodness, friends, is not your enemy. The glory that once meant death now means life. And John is saying here, just look at him. Really, look at him. And the only sane response, friends, is awe, which is why we got to do something with that awe. Here's the final thing today. Receive the fullness only he can give. It's a short phrase here, full of grace and truth. That's how it ends. That's it. Interesting. I notice he doesn't say, Jesus balanced grace and truth, or he doesn't say he was mostly gracious with a dab of truth, or he was mostly truthful with a touch of grace. No, Jesus is full of both grace and truth. You can't separate them from him. Jesus doesn't soften holiness to reach sinners, and he doesn't harden holiness to crush them either. It's both. Verse 16 says, out of his fullness we have all received grace in place of grace already given. Now, I find that awkwardly written in the NIV, which is why I really prefer the English Standard Translation of this. It's literally grace upon grace. That's it. In Jesus, we receive grace upon grace. That's layers. Grace upon grace. Meaning, you don't outrun or exhaust the grace of God. You don't age out of it. It keeps on coming. Not because you're steady, because most of us aren't steady all the time. But he sure is. And then John reminds us why. Verse 17. For the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. I know some of you have heard the word law. You've read it before. So it's a bit confusing for some of you. Let me tell you what the law could do. The law could diagnose the disease called sin. That's it. It's a diagnostician. But it couldn't heal. It couldn't remove the disease. The law could declare us guilty, but it could not make us alive. How many of us sitting here today have spent our entire lives, sadly, even as Christians, operating under some sense of the law that means that God is perpetually distant, disappointed, and evaluating your grades to decide if he wants to see you? Hear me, that is not the voice of God. That is the echo of shame. Jesus came to give you what you could never earn. That's why we need the promise John gives us in this passage in verse 12. Yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave them the right to become children of God. That's identity language. Last week, we talked a lot about being adopted and how we can call God Abba Father, which means we're not tolerated. We're not spiritually fostered by him for a while. If you know Jesus, he views you as a child that he'd take a bullet for. Or worse, a cross. How often have we lived like Christianity means working for God's approval? This verse says the opposite. You don't work for approval, you live from it. What a supernatural thing. Verse 13 sort of outlines that. Children born not of natural descent, nor of human decision, or a husband's will, but born of God. Meaning, you don't become his child by tradition or effort or your bloodline. You become his because God wanted you. Because he moved towards you so you could belong to him. So, hear the anchor verse one more time as I prepare to close. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. One sentence can change everything. And the question this Advent I put before you, before every heart, is simple. Will you receive it? Not admire him, not sing about him for a season, receive him. Because to receive him is to be forgiven and adopted and remade and restored and filled with the joy he meant for you to have. Joy strong enough to stand when the world feels dark, or when your life perhaps feels dark due to your circumstances. This is the sentence that can change your December, friends. This is the sentence that can change your eternity. Let's pray. Almighty God, we thank you for your purposes, your decrees, for sending forth your beloved Son, that we have opportunity to have seen and know about you through him, the one who lived amongst us, who lived the lives we couldn't, who bore what we couldn't, all in our place, who freely offers towards us the privilege of becoming your child if we would bow the knee to him as king, if we would receive his sacrifice for us, receive the good news of the gospel promise. I pray, Lord, that you would not allow that for any of us to be something we're so familiar with that it just passes us by. Awaken us once again to sing your praises today with joy.